I've mentioned Lord George MacLeod, MacLeod of Funerary, to you before. The very Reverend Dr. George MacLeod, former moderator of the Church of Scotland, founder of the Iona community in Scotland, a remarkable man. I wish I'd met him. I've met his spirit in passing, and it is magnificent. It is said that when he first went to Iona to begin to finish the cathedral there and to add to the buildings that needed to be repaired, taking a group of unemployed shipwrights with him and young men heading for the ministry of the Church of Scotland with him to live on the beach and to spend time there until they'd built the place. It is said that when he went there in the first few days, he would walk up and down around the ruins of the cathedral with a walking stick, and he would see stones dug into the ground which had not been moved for years, and he would say, "That's my stone." And someone would dig it out and carry it back to the cathedral, and then he'd say, "Another, that's my stone." And then later on he'd go down the little roads on Iona and come to a farmer's stone fence and say to the farmer, "That's my stone." And he'd make the farmer dig it out of the wall and take it back to the cathedral. And out of farmhouses, "That's my stone," he'd say. And the farmer would dig half his wall out and give it to George MacLeod to take back to build the cathedral. And that's the way it worked, digging out the stones. And George MacLeod wrote this: "In our natural lives, we are undirected stones. Still short of our destiny, even a stone becomes itself when it's shaped and used. To be baptized is to be chosen out, to be marked by the master builder, and to be fashioned in a place of his appointing, in the living temple of which he is the chief cornerstone. Nor, if the choosing has been authentic, can we ever permanently fall away. We may get lost in secular constructions for long enough, the marks of our true purpose hidden at least from mortal eyes, but we can always be built back." Love the man. I listened very hard at the Lessons in Carol service this year, realizing it's going to be my last one, so I was listening very hard with both ears and heart, and I listened to every word, and I heard every note, and it was magnificent. I heard the bones of our faith story being told again from start to finish, our awakening into something amazing. We search through ancient stories and primal texts to flesh out meaning. That's what we do. We read the Greek fables, we read the Roman poems, we read the poetry of the Victorians and others to discern meaning for our lives. And they're about love and war and about lost and found and about death and new life. The conviction has been that we human beings have been visited and redeemed by the power at the heart of everything. We've been visited and redeemed by the power at the heart of everything. We've experienced a clear sense that we are a guided mystery. Our birth and our life are of infinite meaning, and the way we live and the way we treat others is of primary importance. That's why I lie awake nights in silent rage at the movement of the world towards the political right, moving away into populism. Why would we spend time putting up fences and borders and separating ourselves from each other when we are one flesh and one spirit? Why make life harder for people for reasons that are foolish from root to stem, I say to myself in the night. As we let our imaginations explore this amazing road that's open for us, we see that these primal life questions and choices we need to make have always been part of the human experience. What shall we do with our limited time here, we ask ourselves, and with the broad canvas on which we are invited to paint our lives, we ask ourselves, and with our fellow travelers. A friend at Christmas gave me two books from his family collection. I value them very much. They were printed in the late 19th century. One was the stories and the history of Robert Burns, the Scottish poet, and the other was Sir Walter Scott. Well, I've been to Abbotsford, Scott's home in Tweedsdale in Scotland, and I've sat in his chair, and I sat at the desk at which he wrote his poetry and his Waverley novels. But to read about him was quite remarkable. It was said of Sir Walter Scott that he was the friendliest and most gregarious man you'd ever want to meet. People simply loved to meet him and loved to see him. And when he wrote with tremendous brilliance. He wrote The Lay of the Last Minstrel, a great long narrative poem. And when I read it, I thought to myself, how in the world did he write this? How did he do that? How did he rhyme every second phrase and make them absolutely perfect? And it was said that he simply sat down and wrote them. And a friend said when he was writing the Waverley novels, in order to bring himself out of inappropriate debt, you couldn't see him sitting at his desk. All you could see was the piles of paper in the top of his head. And writing with a quill pen, you could see the pages flying off the desk about 2 per minute as he wrote the Waverley novels off the top of his head. Such brilliance. And when he died, they actually took the top off his skull and took his brain out to see why he was so smart. Sir Walter Scott, he's the person in the world with the second greatest number of statues to him, the first being Robert Burns. Well, I was thinking, what do you do with the great icons? You have to do something with the great icons. They help us to answer the questions in life. How did a person live such a noble life? Where did such brilliance come from? Where did such understanding come from? And how can we, in our brief years and with our canvas, begin to do the same kinds of things, the basic questions? Very early in the Christian church, somewhere within the first 75 years, a rich and deep theological understanding was developed. And I've always been unclear as to how quickly it developed or where it came from. How did they know so fast such a deep understanding of the messianic hope? I wondered if perhaps the messianic hope was already a system fully developed, and it was only the story of Jesus that became the catalyst by which the story could best be told. He became the sharp end of the pencil, so to speak. I've just been thinking along those lines. It's unclear as to where this deep theology came from, but you know for sure that this is not rural fisher folk sitting down after a long day at sea and writing their thoughts. The authorship here is of academic and linguistic brilliance beyond measure. And then the Gospels came along later than the letters, later than the theology, and in their seeming simplicity, they seemed to mute that theological thought. They hid it in seemingly simpler stories and sayings. The Gospels are sweet, we say, but they're not particularly deep, we say. But you have to realize they aren't simple. The big themes are still there, but they're wearing rough country dress by now. These are stories and conversations and miracles and friendships, and beneath them is the blazing certainty, the same certainty that the living God is here. I feel that Jesus, the first century Jewish teacher and the rebel, the one who walked the earth for such a brief period of time, has actually been lost in the Gospels, and in his place is the eternal God figure in the flesh. What you're reading about in the Gospels is the eternal God walking and working among us. It's a step up from any earthly figure. The church is not writing the biography of Jesus in the Gospels. It is painting its own faith story, what it has seen and come to believe, and it uses it to teach those who are asking who we are. This is what we've seen, says the church in the Gospels. This is who we are, and this is what it means. And these days, of course, we move far away from Jesus, the first century Jew. We know very little about him, really, other than a simple humanity that we all share. So we may see Jesus these days as a savior, someone who looks after our needs and our hopes and our dreams. This is the Jesus of the child's bedside prayer. Fair enough. And we may see Jesus as a hindrance somehow. A hindrance, allowing people to hide in human entitlement and arrogance and inaction. We hear people say, we have Jesus, we don't need anything else. Don't tell us about social justice and inequity and global warming and the face of the future and ethnic difference and gender disparity. Don't talk. We have Jesus, and that's enough. The rest of the world can go to hell, it says, Jesus the hindrance. Or Jesus can become a blazing, all-encompassing light beyond which we cannot see the wider range of our human nature and responsibilities. Do others not have visions? Other writers and thinkers? Any people who've lived to raise us? Any people who live around us to give us new thoughts and new ways of looking at the world? We say, Jesus, Jesus, it's all about Jesus, and nobody else counts. The light is too bright. Ernest Campbell, who was one of the great ministers at the Riverside Church in New York, gathered a group of us a number of years ago, and he said, these days, the church has put gilding all over Jesus Christ and stands him in the middle of the fellowship and puts a guard around him. Nobody gets near Jesus, and we all keep our eyes on Jesus. He says Jesus was never a center. Jesus was always an edge. And the key is not to look at Jesus. It's to look with Jesus to see what Jesus was looking at. That's a change of direction, isn't it? The story of Jesus in the Gospels is a story that's intentionally created by the writers. It's art for the sake of faith. The congregation that commissioned it said, write something with our accent and our experiences in your writing, and we will use it to teach one another and to teach those who come to the door. Add in the common touches, the human encounters, the personality types you meet along the way, and you've got a literary panorama for the fireside and the classrooms. And these stories have staying power. We know they do. We read them every Sunday. We read them in the quietness of our home. We read them in times of crisis. I learned them at my mother's knee, and they carry me through my life every day into my old age. The Old Testament giants lifted high the lantern of faith, and the prophetic voices lit the flame, and Jesus and we catch fire and glow as witness. That's the way it works. And so churches cherry-picked texts from ancient treasure stores to offer a web of dreams, and together they present the big picture. And the big picture is there is a God at work. There is a God alive in particular people and in particular moments. Isn't that hopeful? You go out into the world realizing there's a God alive out there in particular people, in particular moments. This could be our day. And that the impact is always transformative. That's the message. But what's the plan? The writer chose Isaiah chapter 60 because in it he saw things you never saw before. He writes a poem in a time of war and dysfunction in which he says, peace has come, and those who are lost in alienation are coming home. That was the experience of people coming to faith in Jesus Christ. Isaiah chapter 60 originally gave poetic meaning to a battle which took place in the Persian Empire. It became a doorway for peace and reconciliation. It was only a start. But a start allowed a shaft of light which changed everything. We in Canada live in a time of peace and reconciliation, and it's only a start. But we can see the light in our streets, and we turn towards the light, and we shall, by its grace, make a difference. It's as if a great light has dawned, writes the poet. We've not been abandoned or forgotten. It isn't wrong to have faith. We shall know moments of clarity. Indeed, you sow seed on a variety of grounds, and some of it dies and some of it swallowed up. But even a little bit of it on good ground will give bounty 100-fold, and we will experience its greatness. It's a critical, deeply sound thing to value your homeland and your family ties and to honor your own. And when all is said and done, we get to go to the heartland of home. That's the essence of Isaiah's poem. The last question in One Question Bible Study, the group that used to meet on Sunday mornings over the years, the last question for the last session was, what's the point? What's the point of doing all this on a Sunday? The hymns, the music, the prayers. What's the point of, of gathering together? It's a good question. It came out of a biblical text, but I thought it was important to ask our group of 14 or 15 people, well, what's the point? And we got talking about that because it's a very bright and interested group. And the idea for the question came from a family party at which we were sitting around, and one of our 13-year-old grandchildren said, what's the point of marriage? We said, what? The point of marriage. What's the point of marriage? Well, come on. What's the point of marriage? Well, it's a social contract. It comes from the Middle Ages to make sure that property wasn't transferred inappropriately. It was a way of knowing who your children are. It keeps people calm. It allows structure. It allows jewelers to make wedding rings. Come on and on and on you go. And then we realized that there are 1,000 ways to have a relationship, and there are 100 different ways to live your life, and there are marriages that are miserable, and there are joyful hand-holding relationships that are spectacular, and we realized we couldn't come up with much of an answer except it's a good idea and don't ask any more questions till you're 17. So what's the point of us doing this, the point of us being here all the time? It's a singular way of being together, you know. There's no other place in the culture that does it just like this, week by week. And it's a strange little thing coming from the Reformation. The way we construct worship is from the Reformation, and we follow something older than synagogues, older than thousands of years, the same pattern week after week all over the world. But there seems to be great value in being valued, simply being valued as people, seeing each other together in this place, and of being heard, and of being appreciated for who you are, and of being forgiven, quiet moments of being forgiven, and being protected, and being cheered for. Somebody cheers for me here. They may boo me out in the world, but they cheer for me here. And sharing the range of our pain, if we dare, and the heights of our joy, if we will. Darkness that envelops lives is more clearly seen because the light of places like this redeems us by its brightness. That's part of the reason, surely, for being here. We've seen a great light, and that's the plan. So on the social scene, it's not the obvious power players who are of vital importance. It's always the caregivers, the courageous ones. It's always the watchkeepers, the daring, vulnerable. It's always those in a minority, always those who are suspect, always those in danger. The letter to the Ephesians, which is also a brilliant theological tome, not written by Paul, probably it does not contain his language or his phrasing, but written by someone in the style of Paul, intentionally so. In it, the author speaks about the cost of seeing the light. If you are going to live by the implications of seeing the light, you're going to become a target for agents who prefer darkness to light. We must revisit the framework of our understanding of suffering. The church down the centuries has defined suffering in a small way. It says we'll set up all kinds of moral and ethical rules, and then we'll play the blame and shame game until you feel so terrible you do it our way. Probably give us your money and not give us a hard time, and all will be well. And so we spend our time suffering and worrying in pools of guilt and loss. That's not biblical suffering at its root. The suffering for faith is profound suffering, social suffering. It is soul suffering. The suffering of those who see and live in the light is suffering of frustration. How can darkness be so evil, we say, so full of cruel malice, we say. The beauty of people is being spoiled every day. How can this be the suffering of frustration? And it's the suffering of compassion. How can we live in ways in which we perpetuate war and loss and bombings and sadness and refusal and walls and distance and difference? How can we do that when we see the beauty of people, when we get to know them and know that beauty in ourselves, the suffering of compassion? And it's the suffering of slander and mockery. How can clear, clean, beautiful people be sacrificed for unworthy ends and aims? How can you make political decisions that lie in the face of the truth and shove your lie down? How do you do that? Give us Barabbas, the crowd shouted. We have no king but Caesar, the crowd shouted. And the hearts of humanity wept in their suffering. The story of Jesus Christ is a story of the divine vanguard in all this. He has been called the Suffering One, the one who bears in his goodness the alienation of the whole world. This is saga. This is theatrical brilliance. This is the operatic climax of the piece. This involves everyone, believers or non-believers alike. Whatever the Christ is, it has borne the suffering of the world to bring the light to us and to set us free. It's a message for the world. The whole world is the recipient of the light and life of the Magi. Legend says that the Magi began to search after their country was devastated by war, and they turned their backs on war and its pain and went seeking the star. Legend says that they risked the discomfort of newborn life. There's always a measure of discomfort in that. And in newborn ideas, they carried new ideas festering inside them to follow the star. Legend says they showed the star and its light to people who had been blind to it when they went back home by another road. That's the plan at work. Release the captives, it says. Call forth heroes, it says. Give spine to yourself. Give grit to the least and the lost, it says. That's the plan. Those who seek the deep mystery and are hungry for it and follow it, even though it's frustratingly distant, find culmination in the quest. That's St. Matthew's message. That's the plan. Starlight and earthly geography meet. The power of our newborn humanity holds the key. We finally get our values straight and offer our richest earthly treasure to its revelation. The plan is the conviction that we are reborn by a powerful spirit, a powerful encounter. We create wise searchers and release joyful angels within ourselves, and the world is transformed. That's the plan. That's what the season of Advent and Christmas has been all about. The plan is to sense it and to see it and to believe it, and to follow its meaning as it moves in you and as it moves in all things. Follow the star, follow your eyes to the light. It's still shining. Follow the plan.